Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast, and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. I will give a very broad viewer discretion of advice due to the nature of the topics that we'll be discussing today. Today, I am joined by Gemma. Gemma, welcome to the podcast.
Hey Zach, it's lovely to be here.
Absolutely. So let's jump right in and give a the Cliff Notes version of who you are, because we'll jump more in and ask you some questions about your experiences and the work that you do. But just give us like a overview of who Gemma is, where you are in the world, and just give us an overview of who you are.
Okay, sure. So I'm a trauma recovery mentor from the UK. I work with a broad range of trauma survivors, mainly working from my lived experience, but also from qualifications as a life coach too. So, yeah, I'm quirky. I live with my mom, and yeah, I care for her too. So that's me in a nutshell.
Absolutely. It sounds incredible, and I take care of my mom as well. And it's a lot. It's a lot to deal with. It's a lot to handle. And, also like the weight of the world too, but she's also able to take care of herself completely too. I'm just here to kind of like, help clean up things every now and then and, just do all that, other things.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm really excited, to welcome you to the podcast today because you bring a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience. So let's jump in and talk about what led you to doing the trauma work that you do and working with other trauma survivors. And what's that experience been like for you?
That experience, wow, it's so rewarding. And I first got started working with trauma survivors, having been through trauma twice, maybe three times in my life, if you count the death of my father as well. So yeah, I wanted and needed to channel all that to enable people to become empowered and feel like they can gain their lives back after trauma.
Because we know that healing is not linear, it's a process. And that's the aspect of that. And how broad like healing looks. And what may have worked for me may not have worked for you or the next person. There's so many different ways of healing, and everybody does it completely different and handles that trauma in very different ways.
That is so true.
And coming from your perspective, looking in, I'm here based in the United States. So, what are you seeing as far as like survivor wise from your perspective looking in on the United States? What are you seeing right now?
I'm seeing so many brave people coming out and telling their truths. And coming from somewhere like the UK, in which people can be very guarded, due to society and people sometimes disbelieving. It can be so empowering to hear stories of others and also very reassuring in that people don't feel like they're on their own. There's absolutely power in the people when it comes to surviving something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the United States is in a very dark, harrowing time right now. And, we still have not released the Jeffrey Epstein files. We're seeing healthcare going out the window, literally, with people's IUDs. Sorry, Gwen, had to add that in there because my co-founder is an independent music artist. Her name is Gwen Levy of Gwen Levy and the Breakdown. And in her song, Barefoot and Pregnant, she wrote throw it out the window with her IUD because, courts. I always say that if you don't have a court determine your future, you need to shut the hell up. Because if you're not a woman, if you're not LGBTQ, if you're not disabled, if you're not a person of color, if you're not a survivor of sexual and gender-based violence, and this court, what they decide doesn't determine your future. Sit on the sidelines and let the people who actually are closest to that problem that have the best solutions.
Yeah,
We're the
exactly.
ones that these decisions are directly impacting.
100%.
And the suffering and the animosity and everything else that's going on right now towards the Jeffrey Epstein survivors is so detrimental. And it sets a tone for all of us who have been through trauma. And whenever the president of the United States sits here and states directly that a conflict between a man and a woman or a husband and wife is not considered domestic violence and it should not be prosecutable. Whenever you have your president sit here and directly say that, as a domestic violence survivor myself, my mom is a domestic violence survivor, and countless others that I talk to are also domestic violence survivors. That not only says that our lives do not matter, it also says that this system is working exactly how it was designed. It's going
Oh,
back to
yeah.
those direct roots of the colonization. It goes back into the corruption within the systems itself. But it also says that the president doesn't see domestic violence as something that's a major problem. Here in the Kansas City metro area, in Missouri, so the heart of the United States, we have a astronomical rate of homicides that are continuing. It's a continuing trend, and we're seeing this ongoing trend. 19 of those homicides are domestic violence related. 19 of them are domestic violence related. So, looking in, from your perspective, you see the Jeffrey Epstein files not being released. It's on, literally on the headlines nonstop. But this doesn't only impact the United States. This also goes internationally. Like, he didn't only do these horrific things in the United States, it goes international. This is one of the biggest sex trafficking and human trafficking cases, literally in the entire world, because and it's so complex. And the brave survivors, went to Washington, D.C., and they had a press conference and they shared their stories. And we sat down and interviewed Jess Michaels, who's a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor. And we thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with her, and hearing her speak from her perspective, like obviously seeing it on news and things like that, they added a lot of that. But hearing her raw story, I think it really opened my eyes a lot about what's really happening. And I think it's incredibly important. So, seeing from your perspective, what's your thoughts just from what I just stated about the Jeffrey Epstein files and, the homicide rate here in Kansas City? Just give me an overview of what you're thinking. Like, what do you see?
At the end of the day, it seems to me that survivors, well, they're trying to silence survivors, and in turn that of course invalidates their experiences, you know? It stops or tries to stop them from speaking out. And what that does in turn is it crushes not only their experiences but their personalities as well, because when you go through trauma, it's not only your mental health it affects, it's your emotional and physical health as well.
Exactly.
And sometimes that doesn't get spoken about enough because people just think, oh, it's a mental health problem. And it's really not. It's somebody coming into your space without consent. And I don't think that gets reiterated enough.
We have this like ongoing thing that everything has to be perfect and the perfectionism. And I know you talk about this. So I would love to hear your perspective on what perfectionism looks like and what it is and why it's so like it puts a damper on a lot of lives, because you have to be this, you have to be that, you have to fit into this box. So, and whenever a survivor comes forward, they step outside of that box. You know what I
Oh,
mean?
yeah.
And
Yeah.
what does perfectionism look like to you, like from your perspective, and why is it important that we kind of like step outside that box and take a look and, reflect on our previous self before this trauma? I know this goes into like your life coaching, and which I think is incredible. I've worked with a life coach before and I had a really good experience with it. It really kind of like shifted a lot of my thinking and a lot of my perspectives and
Oh, it
really helped
does.
me overcome a lot of that massive trauma that I faced. But what are your, just walk me through your journey of becoming a life coach. What was that like for you? What led you into doing that? Let's talk about your own experiences and your own story. As much as you're, able to, I will never force anybody to say anything that they don't want to state. But I think it's
Oh,
important
you know me, I'm an
recognizing,
open book.
yeah, I think it's very important to recognize, where people directly come from and like their stories and what led them into doing the work that they're doing.
Yeah, of course. I mean, for me, when I was at school, I was a quiet goth kid, sat at the back trying to get on with her work and whatever. But because of that, I was ignored and I struggled. I had to teach myself. And so I would try as hard and hard and harder as I could to get the best results and the best grades. And I always hit the middle ground when it came to grades until I went to college. And my first college, it was a breeze. But between that and going to college, I was assaulted sexually by my next door neighbor. I came out as gay, having known that I was gay since the age of 8. I came out at the age of 13. I then went to court because of the sexual assault that happened and sat in the witness room. I was given a bundle of messages sent between me and my abuser. And those messages never got touched. And all they could focus on was the fact that I was gay. So I got sat in that room for 2.5 hours being quizzed on that. So I had to pick up and learn to deal with that. I was told by a counselor to just put it in a box and shove it on the shelf and forget about And after,
No, you're perfectly fine, and I think you're on like a really good track of explaining like what led directly into this. And first of all, I want to say, thank you for sharing that perspective. Thank you for sharing, going to court, and because oftentimes survivors do not face their perpetrator in court, because here in the United States, our courts comply with the perpetrator typically. And I think that's an incredible aspect. I would love for you to kind of like dive into that, a little bit, and what that experience was really like for you. And
Of course.
I think that's an incredible perspective, because looking at the UK court versus like the US court, I think it's definitely, there's a disconnect there, right? And it's a different experience. So I would love for you to hone in on that specifically as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a 13-year-old, I was classed definitely as a minor over here. The age of consent isn't until 16. And I was told that I would be sat in a room with the witness support. I had my responsible adult sat in the courtroom watching everything. And I literally felt the weight of everything on my shoulders in that moment, you know, all the responsibility and different things like that, that I felt like I had to do it justice to be able to get him found guilty. So, in the days after that, the policewoman came round to the house and she told me and my mum that he had been found not guilty. And I can't tell you how annoyed, frustrated, and angry I felt in that moment. It felt crushing. So when it came back to me going to school, school was the last thing on my mind. I struggled through it. I struggled through my GCSEs to the point that I can't remember what actually happened during my GCSEs because I was so concerned with everything else that I appeared really laid back with my GCSEs and can't remember doing much revision. So yeah, that was a whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine what that would be like and what that would feel like, you know, hearing, you know, you go through your trauma, you know, you have to like telling your story like after it can be very debilitating and it can be very draining and it can be very, you know, re-traumatizing. It feels like a re-victimization at some points. And so I can imagine what that would be like receiving or, you know, being told, well, we found him not guilty. Like it's like all of that just feels like it's just like, you know, if you think about it, it's kind of like you're in a snow globe, right? And this is like being constantly like shaken, you know what I mean? Like, and it's like those feelings that your whole world is like literally crumbling around you. It's like I tell this story, I think people are going to understand it, I think people are going to resonate with it, and then whatever they don't and they find a person not guilty, that's very debilitating.
It is. It is. And you feel just completely invalidated and as though you're worthless.
And you said that they honed in really heavily on the fact that you're LGBTQ. What was that like for you?
That was so weird for me because I was kind of used to it, you know. I was used to talking to mom about being LGBT and I felt at home with my identity. And so to have that questioned as though I was using it as an excuse and that was a reason for him to get away with what he did. It was heartbreaking. I mean, my dad, when he was alive, he did not like that next door neighbor at all. But my dad didn't know that I was LGBT either. So, looking at it from a horrible point of view that I really don't want to look at it from. Yeah, it was awful being questioned in that way. And to know that the jury sat there and listened to that 13-year-old girl in that witness box. To all these questions about my sexuality and my personality being just decimated in that
Absolutely. I can imagine what that would definitely be like. I can. Now, my question to you is, you know, and I know, like you said, you read open books, so I'm going to ask this direct question. Do you feel that you being LGBTQ played into them not finding him guilty? Do you feel that that played a key role, or do you feel like it's just a systematic failure, or what's your perspective on that?
Okay. Knowing the area that I grew up in and gay people not being accepted, I would definitely say yes, it did.
From my perspective here in the United States, we look over to the UK and we're like, okay, there's some good work happening, and it's like they really have everything very well put together, right? But then in the end of it, we recognize that this is not just the United States system, this is the world's system.
Oh, yeah.
And whatever the United States does, it seems like it kind of like trickles through like the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. It's like a knock-on effect.
Yes. And we like to call it the Trump effect. But that's definitely something that's kind of happening, but not just Trump, because this goes back like many like presidencies ago in the United States. This goes way back. And whenever we think about the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system, the family court system, all these systems are working exactly how they were designed. Oftentimes we hear that a system is broken. How can a system be broken when it was hurt? It was meant to hurt people like my mom, being a disabled woman, being, going through her cancer treatment right now. Like, there's a very real possibility that at any moment, the president of the United States and this administration can say, your health care does not matter. We are taking your health care away from you. It is a very real reality that so many people are facing right now. And then you see people like communities being torn apart by violence, by domestic violence, gun violence. We have mass shootings that continue to happen across the United States, left and right. And this is, and speaking of left and right, this isn't a left and right issue. This is a literal lack of leadership issue bipartisanly. Whenever a gun violence situation happens in our schools, we oftentimes hear thoughts and prayers. It's beyond time for thoughts and prayers. It's time for that policy and action. And whenever we think about violence prevention, we also need to focus on that violence postvention, the after effect. How do we move forward as a
I mean,
community?
it strikes me, and it's completely, absolutely bloody ridiculous that people only speak out after something happens and not before.
And then if they do speak out after, it's literally that thoughts and prayers. I'm so sorry that you lost your loved one, but I'm still
Oh,
not going
yeah.
to do anything about this because, oh, we can't impede on this, we can't impede on that. And the
Yeah.
United States has the highest rate of gun violence within the entire world. It is literally the highest gun violence rate per capita. Like, if we look at that, and we can dive into statistics, on a later episode. But I think it's very interesting to sit and look at the world view and kind of hone in on different parts of the United States, but also focus on the UK and like Australia and France and like all these other places, and look at
Oh,
like their
absolutely.
statistics and look at the stories that are coming from there. You see a whole different perspective. And thinking about that, today is October 12th, and hate crimes are still very active in the United States. And one hate crime that I think about and I go back to, and I'll give a backstory on this here in a second, but Matthew Shepard, like, this wasn't just something that was random. This was plotted. He was a 20, either 21 or 22-year-old gay student. And he was found brutally beaten and left for dead. It was around Halloween time. People thought that he was a Halloween prop. And then they realized, as because
Oh
this was
my gosh.
during the night, whenever they came back and discovered that this was an actual human being, they found him. They took him to the hospital, and unfortunately, this was back in, like I said, in 1998. It would have been October 8th, whenever he was found. Unfortunately, he passed away 4 days later. Today is that anniversary. And back in 2016, I and my mom, or my mom and I, traveled to Denver, Colorado, which is south of where Laramie, Wyoming, or where Laramie, Wyoming is, which is where Matthew lived at the time, and that's where he was found.
Okay,
And
yeah.
we went to the Matthew Shepard Foundation Gala, and I accepted the Spirit of Matthew Award in
Oh, wow.
2016. And I think that has to be the most exciting experience that I've had in my advocacy journey, next to creating this movement. Which
Absolutely.
what led me to create the movement is because of those stories like Matthew. And I ask myself very often, am I the next Matthew Shepard? Am I the next, Marsha P. Johnson or Sylvia Rivera, that were brutally like the systems literally failed them. Like,
Yeah.
it's such a devastating time to recognize and to look back at that and seeing that history erased. That is
Yep.
the, I mean, they can erase words, they can ban words and do whatever, but you're not going to erase the people that are behind those words. And you can do whatever you think. You can erase diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's still, we're still going to do it. We're still going to
Yeah.
recognize it. You can eliminate words, but you can't eliminate the people that are those words. And that's the reality of that. But I think back to learning about Matthew Shepard at a younger age. I wasn't a lot, or I was 2 years old in 1998, and I just turned 29 this year. And I think about that, 27 years later, how many other hate crimes have we seen across the globe? There's so many. Matthew's story in people like Matthew, it doesn't just happen in the United States. It's
No, it doesn't. It doesn't
all
at
over.
all. Yeah.
So hearing the story of Matthew Shepard, I think it kind of shook me to my core, and it made me recognize the ongoing issue that we continuously have. And I think, receiving that award directly from his father, I think that was definitely an eye-opening moment for me, hearing him say, you embody Matthew's spirit. I think that is what really hits me.
Yeah.
And that those are like the best words that you could probably ever hear from somebody, especially somebody that you look up to so incredibly much.
Yeah.
That was also the day that I met Sean Hayes,
Oh,
aka
wow.
Just Jack from Will and Grace, right?
Yeah.
But let's jump in and talk about, you becoming a life coach, right?
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Like getting that certification, becoming certified, like walk us through that journey for you.
It felt like I finally had something that I could do that was proactive for survivors, but not only for survivors, but myself as well. It felt like I could finally put my lived experience and put that to good use instead of use it to hold me back and keep me in the same rut. You know what I mean? Because very often when you go through trauma, you just feel trapped and you just feel claustrophobic. So I needed to break out of that and I needed to be able to help others. And it allowed me to feel proud of what I accomplished getting that certification.
Absolutely. What was the journey like? Like what training did you have to go through? Like what type of training was it? Because obviously there's a lot to it. You're helping others like guide through this trauma. What was that training like for you? And what was your thoughts like running through that training? Did you see a lot of things that would have helped you going through when you went through? What was that part like for you?
Yeah. So I had to work through the training mostly online, which was great for me. And most of the questions and worksheets that I got, they were all stuff that I was able to apply to my own life going through. And that gave me the opportunity to see where some of it matched and some of it didn't, because of course, this was a one track thing, you know, this was just a standard thing that a group of students were doing. And when I was going through it, I thought, you know, this is great, but there are things that are missing and that I can tailor towards trauma survivors and be able to help a larger group of people that I felt had been silenced for so long. So going through it, I made changes. I got my pens out and started scribbling down different ideas and things that I'd struggled with and different things like that. And it allowed me to be able to look at something and say, well, hey, this shouldn't be tailored towards one person. This should be able to be personalized to whoever I'm coaching at that time. So, yeah, I went down that rabbit hole and just delineated it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever I think of like life coaching, right? I think of sitting in a space and it's just, it's just you and this life coach, and you're kind of like explaining the things that you've experienced. You're explaining, this is what I'm currently doing and it's not working, right? And it's separate from like therapy because it's not therapy. It's definitely, but it oftentimes going through like life coaching is actually oftentimes better than therapy, right?
Yeah, because you get proactive steps, right?
Versus having medication thrown at you, or
Oh
you
my
have,
gosh, yeah.
which I've been on like hundreds of medications and not a single one of them works the way that my medicinal marijuana does. I'll be first to say it. I will be first to say it because I feel like incredibly calm, but I haven't smoked in like several weeks because I'm still dealing with the after effects of having COVID,
Of
and
course,
my
yeah.
lung capacity is not where it needs to be. If I take a really deep hit, well, I'm liable to end up passing out, and I don't want to do that. So I'm
Yeah, no,
still
not good.
finding ways of doing it, but this podcast has been really rewarding for me, and it's been definitely a like an eye-opening, and it's brought people together.
It's good to find a purpose as well, isn't it?
It
Like to help
is.
others.
And do you feel like you found your purpose in doing like the life coaching? It's like a full 360 moment for you, you know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I found life coaching, then I went through therapy in 2021, I want to say. No, 2022, that's it. Because I still wanted to break down what I went through with the sexual assault more. And during that time, it was so interesting because I look back now and I didn't say anything about the abuse I suffered in a coercive relationship. I stayed dumb. And I think that was, well, I know it was my own prejudice because I thought, well, how is somebody going to understand that I went through that if I can't understand it? So I thought, whoa, there needs to be some work to be done because I find myself cringing at myself.
Oh, absolutely. I can definitely imagine that.
And I sought out another therapist that was qualified in LGBT stuff. And we worked through things together. And it was the first time that I'd been able to piece together what went on in that relationship because I'd still had so many questions and so many pieces that I could remember, but I didn't have reasons for. And there was one particular night in that coercive relationship, and I'd been diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome. And me and my partner were sat talking about it and this, that, and the other. She wanted a family, as did I. But I wasn't prepared to do what she wanted me to do to get a family. And so we went to bed on an argument. And I think I was somewhere between sleep and awake, you know, that really awkward stage in the middle of the night. I hated it. And I could feel her weight on top of me. And I just laid there and I felt like I couldn't scream, but I wanted to. And it was like I'd frozen, and I felt as though I was looking above the scene. So I disassociated myself completely from where I was. And it was one of those weird things when I talked about it with a therapist, and she said, "How did that make you feel?" And I said, "Violated." And
Absolutely.
I said, "I've only ever felt like that once before. And that was when I was abused as a teenager." So I then did a bit more digging online, as you do. And I thought it was called serious sexual abuse. But what I really knew what it was rape. But over in the UK, we're not allowed to call it that if it happens between two women.
Can you talk about that for a second? Can you, because this is the part where we talked about that during your pre-interview, which everybody who's listening, I do a pre-interview with the people that I interview, and we kind of like discuss angles that we can bring somebody's story from, and it's like a trauma-informed approach to it. But my question is, can you talk specifically about like that part and what that looks like? Because to anybody else outside of that, that's rape, right?
Oh,
But
yeah.
talk about that specific perspective from your viewpoint and knowing what you know about rape, but you can't disguise it as that. You can't talk about it as that. That's got to be, that was a mind-blowing part for me.
Yeah, like our government doesn't class non-consensual sex between two women as rape. So when I was on the Gallup website, which is the LGBT domestic abuse charity over here in the UK, I can actually read for you what it says on their website, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, I think that would be really good knowledge for anybody who's listening by hearing that direct definition. And then what I'll do is I'll read the definition here in the United States as well. So
That would be so great.
let's take a journey. Let's see this really quick.
Yeah. So it says here on the Gallup website, I took this in 6th of February this year. And it said, "We are mindful that the law does not call sexual assault by one woman against another rape. It is called serious sexual assault. For some women, this feels like their experience is viewed as less serious by the law." And then they've gone on to say, "We don't take it less seriously. We understand the impact of violence by women, and we will use the words you want to use." Okay.
So thinking about that, like hearing like the serious sexual assault and seeing it described as that in the UK is very eye-opening to me. Now, here in the United States, you ready for this? In the
Okay.
US, rape is generally defined as sexual penetration or activity without consent, which can be carried out through force, threat, coercion, or by taking advantage of someone who is incapacitated or below the legal age of consent, also known as statutory rape. While definitions and specific laws vary by state, the core elements involve non-consensual sexual activity and varying degrees of penetrative or sexual contact. So it doesn't like break it into, like break it down. It's just a general statement. And then you have state level laws, which is rape is primarily a state level crime. So the precise legal definition what constitutes as a sexual act and specific age of consent differ from state to state. In some parts of the country, the legal age to consent is 17. In other parts of the country where I come from, Kansas and Missouri, it is 18 years old. Now, thinking about that and hearing that, what's your reaction to hearing how we see it versus how, because we just have like a just a general statement, it's not broken down. Obviously, there are statistics that are broken down, and we know that people of color, we know that marginalized communities face higher rates of victimization and of sexual assault, domestic violence, and violence in general. But hearing that, there's definitely some work to do in both of these spaces, obviously, because we know even though we have a definition of what it looks like, is it prosecuted as that? Sometimes it is not. And we also have a thing called a voluntary intoxication loophole in some states. So if you voluntarily got intoxicated, so you know you went to a party and you got drunk and somebody rapes you or sexual assaults you or you know, et cetera, they can throw out those charges because they see it as, well, you know, voluntarily drank. And well, there's some very strong loopholes in that. And even within those loopholes, there's still loopholes, but they're trying to close those loopholes in a couple of different parts of the country and or, yeah, in different parts of the states in the United States. And unfortunately, the most recent one that I was watching in New York, it failed. Even being in a fairly progressive state, it still failed because they don't see it as that. It's a very broad definition of what sexual assault and what rape looks like, but it doesn't have anything about those loopholes. And which means, like I said, you can go to a party, you can get drunk, you can be raped, and those charges potentially can be thrown out depending on how they see it and depending on if they look at it. And it falls within that voluntary aspect. That is insane to me.
I mean, how many of these things are tailored around to victim shaming and victim blaming? And then they're directed almost as if somebody's got hold of this rule book, which is completely, utterly ridiculous. And as a perpetrator of this, and said, right, okay, so what can I write in this so then I would get away with future crimes? That's what it feels like to me.
So I want to pivot here for a second and, you know, acknowledge that yes, you're absolutely correct, 100%. Now, I want to pivot very quickly. Do you remember hearing a story of Izzy Vine in the UK?
No, I don't.
Izzy Vine is a former staff officer in 999. So here in the United States, it's 911, but 999 call handler for the Metropolitan Police in South London, who became a prominent whistleblower and campaigner for police accountability. She is known for speaking out against alleged misogyny, sexism, and systemic corruption within the force. She worked as for the Metropolitan Police there in South London for 5 years, primarily as a 999 call taker. In April of 2023, she raised concerns about a male colleague's offensive and discriminatory comments and behavior. She claimed that instead of being protected, she was pushed out of the force while the colleagues she reported, or the colleague she reported, was reinstated. After leaving the police, Vine founded the community organization Speak Up Now, also referred to as Speak Up Now UK, which supports whistleblowers in public and emergency services. She has also launched a petition for a statutory public inquiry into her case and the broader issues within the Met Police, advocating for Isabel's Law to mandate the public disclosure of police misconduct histories. Vine is currently suing the Metropolitan Police at an employment tribunal for whistleblowing detriment, sex-based harassment, disability discrimination, and constructive dismissal, representing herself in the ongoing case. She uses social media, particularly Instagram, to share her story, raise awareness about institutional failings, and campaign for reform in UK policing. Whenever I hear of the UK, I think of this story. I think of Izzy, which she will be coming on a future podcast episode very soon and talking about, you know, what she's seen, what she's experienced, and the work that she's doing.
Oh, wow, that's going to be so interesting.
And she is, I think, I'll absolutely like send you the episode directly because it's like, I want you to hear this. I
Yeah,
want you to see this. I
absolutely.
want you to hear this because
Send me it.
this is a deep story and this is deep. And coming out against the police department, it takes a lot
Yeah.
of courage. It takes a lot of strength.
Oh, it does. Pure guts.
And I also think about our own issues we have here in the United States. The police department in the city that my mom lives in is very complicit, and they're horrific.
Yeah.
We've seen some things, we've witnessed some things with them, and they're currently under a lot of investigations. There's just a lot happening in the world right now. And so my last question to you is, if there was somebody to message you that was trying to find a healing journey, and think about like your life coaching, let's set that aside for a second. Let's take that hat off, okay? Let's put on the hat, because I know you wear a lot of hats just like I do. But let's put on our survivor hat just for a second and walk through this journey with this person that messages you. What would you? Obviously, again, healing looks different for each person and it's broken down individually. But speaking as, survivors ourselves, I receive DMs on a daily basis saying, what's an organization I could be connected to? Or what do you recommend for this? Or what do you recommend for that? But if somebody was to message you and say, I'm beginning my journey of healing, what would you recommend for them? Because obviously, again, it goes, healing is not linear. It's, multiplex and it's there's different journeys. But
Absolutely.
what would you say to them? Because I know you've probably gotten messages like this, but
Yeah. Normally, I ask people what their support network looks like. Because obviously, people have got either somebody that they can talk to or somebody that they trust that may be outside the family circle or knows them, but just on a basic level. Sometimes that's easier to talk to people like that. But I cannot emphasize the point enough of talking. And sometimes not getting other people's perspectives, that's the wrong thing, but getting somebody else to listen and who can empathize with you. Because that can really help.
it can. And I also think about the definitions of empathy versus sympathy.
Oh, yeah.
And thinking about that, it's not the same thing. A
No,
lot of
it's
people think
not.
that they go hand in hand. They do not. There's actually a
No.
distinct difference. Whenever we hear about sympathy, it's typically whenever somebody dies, right? They're like, oh, I'm so sorry, that you're going through this. But whenever it comes to like overcoming sexual assault and domestic violence and gun violence, we still hear, and it's like a natural instinct for somebody to say, oh, I'm so sorry. But I think it also goes into recognizing the need for empathy versus sympathy. Empathy is like, I am here for you. I don't have that experience myself, but here's, what I've heard that people can do, and here's some suggestions for, self-care and healing. That
Exactly. It's
that's the
more proactive.
Yeah, and it's very empathetic. And I know that if I would have got empathy versus sympathy whenever I went through what I did, the
Oh,
only
yeah.
two people that I got empathy from was my mom and my grandmother. My mom is also a survivor, so it was definitely different for her to hear me come forward about
100%.
mine because she knows what would have helped with her. So she was like, oh, here's what we can do. We can go to the police department, we can report. Little did I know that would backfire on me. And that was actually the beginning of the infamy, because I went down a downward spiral, hearing my own police department say, I don't believe you. You were a man. Why didn't you fight him off? Like, it was
Do you know
very.
what? That's such a crap thing to say, for one, for a better word, because that's like somebody talking down to somebody else. And that's something that 110% you should never do to any survivor on any level. Like, take hierarchy out and chuck it out the blooming window, because come down onto their level, listen. Instead of saying, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you do the other? I heard that so many times from relatives, both times. And I could not describe the freeze, flight, fright motion that your body goes into. And just hearing other people talking down to survivors like that, it just makes me so angry. It really does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's definitely one of those aspects of it that obviously needs to change. That's for most definite. And whenever
Oh,
we think of
yeah.
a police department, we think of protection, we think of security. Obviously, seeing the opposite end of that and being the brunt end of their negligence and taking a survivor serious, it led me down a very deep and dark spiral. You know, through drug addiction, it led me through suicide attempts, it led me through all of those. And I'm very open about my story, you know, kind of like you are. I'm an open book. Like I think the
It's the
more,
best way to be.
yeah, and I understand that not everybody's at that point, and that's completely valid. I will never discredit that. I will never force somebody to share something that
No.
they don't want to share, you know, but there are
Exactly.
people like you and me that do this very deep dive to help them also recognize, like, it is possible for you to get to this state as well, you know,
Yeah.
and there's no time limit for grief. There's no time limit for, you know, recognizing what you went through and understanding it. But and also in different parts of the country also has different statutes of limitations. You know, in Missouri it's 30, I think it's like 32 years after the time the crime occurred, but it also depends on that specific crime. But specifically for sexual assault, I believe it's 32 years within the state of Missouri. So there's not a correct time to come forward. And there's oftentimes a lot of people do
No.
not come forward at all because of that fear of rejection, the fear of retaliation, the fear of losing your housing, your health care, you know, everything. I mean, the government's going to do that anyway, but
Yeah.
all it does essentially is prolong that inevitable. But that's a whole different topic. And that's a whole deeper dive into that. But I want to say thank you, you know, for the work that you do and coming onto the podcast today. Is there anything else you would like to share with anybody at all?
I would just like to say that if you've been through trauma, no matter what it is, that your experience is valid. You have a choice of what to do with your experience. And nobody can invalidate that or should be able to invalidate it. So hold your head up high and own your power.
Yes, absolutely. I entirely agree. Gemma, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. You take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you, Zach, and you too.
Thank you. I appreciate you.